In 1920, some 800,000 men, women, and children worked, schooled, and lived largely within the original city limits, Cleveland. By 1940, there were 1.5 million people sprawled across the 104 governing units into which Cuyahoga County had been gerrymandered. In 1960, there were 3 million of us in a 7-county economic region, of which Cleveland was the financial heart. And by 1980, there will be more than 6 million who live within a 13-county economic region, laced together by the same highway system, interpenetrated by the same news media, and dependent upon the same banking and commercial system. Cleveland has a future. Cleveland is in no danger of becoming a ghost town. Our economic roots are solid and deep in the ground. We provide a convenient location for some of the most significant manufacturing and distribution services performed in the United States. If we depend simply upon sheer physical size or upon population statistics, then we can look to the future with some confidence and say that Cleveland will grow from strength to strength. Some 3 years ago, a scientist at the research laboratories of the Rockefeller Institute in New York City allowed a population of rats to multiply unchecked. He provided them adequate food, he provided them adequate liquid. He did not make any provision for the increase in their cages. He did not improve the living space. For a while, the rats were able to cope with their population explosion. After a while, they became its victims. Some went berserk. Others became catatonic. There were riots in the cage. And there were mothers who watched impassively as their offspring were attacked by outsiders, in much the same way that some city folk will watch a purse snatching or remain indoors when they hear a cry of distress from a woman who is being molested on the streets. The question is not, therefore, does Cleveland have a future? But what kind of future are we going to prepare for our children? The question is not, will Cleveland grow, but how will Cleveland grow? Urbanization is just at its takeoff point. Within 20 years or 40 years, Cleveland will be a great megalopolitan area. There will be 20, 30, 50 million people in this general area, dependent upon one interconnecting economic system. What kind of future are we preparing for these vast masses of our children, of our grandchildren, of our friends? If the immediate past be any indication, one must say that the future is bleak indeed. For though urbanization is just really beginning, we've already allowed it to strip us some of the most important amenities of civilized life. We have lost the lake, Our most important natural resource as a recreation area, as a beauty spot, is nothing more than a stinking cesspool. Our air is polluted. Some scientists say that our air, our atmosphere, is the third filthiest in the nation. There is hardly a clean, fresh water source left in this whole region. We have scoured the countryside with jerry-built developments. Our city has simply spawned ugliness. And we have allowed certain areas of the core city to revert to the jungle, to animal violence. Cleveland is reaping a harvest, a bitter harvest, of indifference, carelessness, greed. And there is very little indication that Cleveland has the vision or the will to husband its human and natural resources more carefully, more intelligently, more humanly than heretofore. Now, the rat is not a man. Our brains are infinitely more supple. Our power to control the environment is infinitely greater. But brains need to be used and powers need to be disciplined. There needs to be social concern. There needs to be a sense of shared partnership and civic enterprise. And I would submit to you that in recent years, Cleveland, taken in its generality, has shown little more than a willingness to feast on the economic abundance of our technological revolution. The recent past offers an indication of future. Clevelanders are willing to have the federal government or a private foundation sponsor research studies to show us how better housing could be built, how a more rational highway system could be constructed, how we could find parks and green spaces, how we could establish quality education, how we could improve the standards of public hygiene, how we could establish metropolitan government. We're delighted to have these studies made. But attach a tax memorandum to them, and we file them away, and show them, and deliberately put them out of mind. We want a good city. Cleveland is a city of civic luncheons, where everyone rises to his feet and speaks in grand generalities of the American promise and Cleveland's dream, the best location in the nation for hot air. And then we go out and we vote, and we prove once again, as we've proved in most elections in most years, that we're not willing to pay for the services. Between citizenship and our pocketbook, Cleveland chooses its pocketbook. We're guilty of being hypocrites. We mow the great Cleveland promise. We even hire engineers to show us how it can be blueprinted. But before it can cost us a sou, before it can raise the millage, we vote it down. We put it out of sight. We see to it that it is committed to death. Oh, how Cleveland loves committees. Committees, but not commitment. Oh, how Cleveland loves the language of American democracy, the language of American promise, but how we run away from the hard work, from the decision-making. Gentility, I'm afraid, has replaced morality as the standard of our civic enterprise. Clevelanders are afraid to call each other by the right names, bluntly, greedy, parsimonious, selfish, self-centered. We want to be friends with everyone. And friendship and a fear to stub on another, to stamp on another man's toes has buried most of our useful civic reforms in the past 20 years. Study Cleveland's history and you find it to be a rather steady chronicle and a sad chronicle of a fall from grace. Now, our fathers were not all saints by a long shot. There were royal barons among them. There were the profligate sons, the prodigals, who spent the family fortunes, who invested them elsewhere where the return was a more agreeable one. But there was in the early days of Cleveland a sense of community responsibility. And when it was necessary, Clevelanders, the well-established and the poor, could come together and could create public policy. And they could see that it was effective. And their courage and their consistency shames our pretense and our public posture. We keep giving ourselves these little plaques of good citizenship. I think there are more awards for good citizenship in the city of Cleveland than the rest of the nation put together. And the only awards for real citizenship that ought to go to anyone in our community belong to a few citizens of the early settlers. The rest of us have yet to earn our spurs. Do you know that Cleveland was the first city in the Western Reserve to tax itself for the education of the indigent? Now, there were some fat cows in those days who complained about their money being spent for the education of children of the ne'er-do-well. But in those days, there were ministers who were not afraid to get up in their pulpits and to thump a little bit and to point the finger and to call greed, greed, and selfishness sin. And Cleveland listened to these plaints of those who earned their profit off the sweat of the laborer's back and called it hard-earned. And Cleveland voted for public education, and public education for all became public policy. And Cleveland set about to create quality education for all. Believe it or not, not so many years ago, our major work classes, our foreign language courses, the qualifications we required of teachers, our technical and vocational training was a model, an educational model for the nation. Now, many of you graduated from those classes, and how did you repay the Cleveland school system? You moved away? You plunged into parent-teacher's activities and school levies for the counter systems? You were concerned lest your children be coarsened and vulgarized by contact with the newer arrivals. Now, perhaps suburbanization was inevitable given the population explosion. But how do you explain the continued financing by our suburbanites, by the graduates of our center city, of the real estate boards, and of the Chamber of Commerce, which year by year saw to it that public school levies were kept at a minimal level, year by year saw to it that school bond issues were lobbied against and, when possible, defeated? Well-established Clevelanders drew their profits from the great industries along the Cuyahoga River, which especially during the war years drew as mill hands the semi-literate and the illiterate from across the nation. And no one wanted to spend part of his dividend check for the extra services which the city of Cleveland had to perform for them and for their children. Oh, no. Everyone was concerned only with his own child. And the plant of our Cleveland educational system deteriorated. Libraries disappeared from the elementary schools. Teachers were no longer paid a salary which was competitive to the salary of the suburban schools. After all, these were our children, and we wanted the best children, best teachers for them. and what once been a grand national example became a national scandal. To be sure that all Clevelanders watched this toboggan slide from grace as if it were a sports spectacle at the stadium, there were the teachers who continued to teach. There were the few who resisted the lure for the suburban systems. There were some citizens who believed in the founding traditions. A new beginning was attempted. And there is today, as you know, a blossoming partnership between the poor, the federal government, foundations, and a minority of dedicated citizens who understand what citizenship is all about. Now, Cleveland's sin is not immorality, but lethargy. Everyone is aghast when you say to them that in large areas of the center city, one half of the students drop out before graduation. Everyone is shamed when one says that a high school diploma is in and of itself not a certificate of employability in the mid-20th century. Everyone is rather stupefied when they are reminded that Cleveland spends $5 for crime and for delinquency for every dollar that it spends for education. It makes no sense. Yet most of us do little more than engage in Cleveland's favorite indoor pastime. Complaint, complaint, and whimpering. We are aghast, we are disturbed, and we remain silent. Only the few are angry and act. Cleveland has a monumental capacity to be an iceberg, to melt without movement, to melt without hope. Now, there are schemes known to many for the improvement of our Cleveland school system, the pairing of districts, the pooling of tax monies, the building of giant educational plants which can serve many of the surrounding areas as well as the core city. And these are not even submitted to the electorate. Why? Because the school boards know full well that if they were submitted, they would be totally and resoundingly defeated. There is no reason to believe that Cleveland has any desire to vote for the education of someone else's child if the money comes out of his own pocketbook. The federal government's willing to pay the money, that's one thing. But if we have to pay it, Cleveland stands four square for its own bank account. A 100 years ago, this city was a hotbed of abolitionist sentiment. Cleveland was one of the northern terminal points of the Underground Railroad. Our cellars hid the runaway slave. Our boats ferried these men across to the free soil of Canada. Did you know the city of Cleveland was the first northern city to send a Negro to the state legislature? Did you know that this was the first major northern city to elect a significant number of Negro councilmen and Negro judges? And do you know that social statisticians today have a hard time finding a more segregated city north of the Mason-Dixon line? 98% of our Negroes live east of the Cuyahoga River. 70% of our Negroes live in census tracts which have 80% or more Negroes within them. 50% of the Negro population of Cleveland lives in census tracts which are 95% Negro or more. This city was once proud of the welcome it was willing to extend to all ethnic groups. What is our cultural gardens down there in the Rockefeller Center but a symbol of the welcome which we said we had for them? There is no Negro garden. There is no Chinese garden. Apparently, Cleveland's welcome stops short of the color line. Now, as long as the older Cleveland, the white Cleveland, lived within the city limits, Cleveland had a fine record of service, of safety, of education, of housing inspection, of cleanliness, of street maintenance, and of all the services which are required for decent living. But once we left the center city, we no longer cared. If industry wanted to dump its lit and its dust in the backyards of the workers, that was industry's prerogative. If industry wanted to dump its refuse into the Cuyahoga River, we drank filtrated water. If industry did not care to pay taxes for housing inspectors in the tenement districts, well, as long as we could drive downtown safely on one or two of the major arterial highways, we didn't worry too much about the squalor behind the storefront or down the side street. If rats were multiplying, if there was violence in the street, if a little child couldn't walk to school without danger of being attacked, if no one saw to it that there was safety for the slum, well, those were other people, not our people. Out of sight was out of mind. Clevelanders, the rich, the well-established, the white, Clevelanders wanted the lowest tax rate possible, and they wanted the city beyond that to pay for many of their own needs and services, water filtration, sewage disposal, the licensing and milk distribution, the zoo, the public parks, for a while the Metropolitan Hospital. We wanted to take from the city, and we were prepared to return to it what? Very little indeed, except our greed. And I'm afraid that as we look back over the last 20 years, we must say that most of the white and the well-established and the older citizens of Cleveland became interested in slum clearance only when the slums threatened to cross the city boundaries. Urban renewal set the slums in motion. Cleveland plunged into urban renewal as Cleveland plunges into many programs without really thinking it through. We raised homes without building relocation housing. We raised acres and acres of tenement living in the name of better living for the Negro and for the poor, and we simply pushed the Negro into more compact spaces. We set the ghettos rolling, and they roll against the boundaries of East Cleveland and across the boundary of East Cleveland. They roll against the boundaries of Cleveland Heights and Shaker Heights, and they began to encroach upon these, our little enclaves of special privilege. And all of a sudden, we became very interested in slum housing, in urban renewal, in public housing. We were prepared even to pay a little price for it. It was better if the federal government paid the cost, but we at least would put in the seed money. We were very interested in slum clearance and urban renewal and public housing, as long as the public housing was down there, where the poor ought to be. Down there in Huff, down there in Central, down there in Cleveland. And all of us have talked about urban renewal and public housing for the city of Cleveland, and there is not one public housing project in any of the 103 other governmental units in Cuyahoga County. For us, we want no part of it. Public housing is simply a way of keeping the slums, keeping the indigent, keeping the poor, keeping the Negro, keeping the Puerto Rican away from our privilege, away from our seclusion, away from the quiet which we think we have on our streets. Oh, it makes a sad story, doesn't it? This fall from grace. Cleveland hired white-collar, white men for white-collar jobs until the federal government threatened the cancellation of lucrative contracts and industry could not afford the luxury of its prejudice. Cleveland did not worry about the racial bars for admission to many of the building trade unions until the federal government threatened to cut off further funds for the building of projects which would enrich our restaurants and our hotels and our shopkeepers. And then we cried bloody murder. Cleveland industry did not particularly concern itself with upgrading the Negro once he had a job in the big manufacturing plants, in fighting the prejudice of the white job superintendent until the federal government began to go in and to investigate and to threaten the cancellation of contracts unless the Negro was put on the same advancement track as his fellow white employee. Our record is one of delay, inaction, unwillingness, and selfishness. Now, of course, there were the saving remnant, the few men of vision. And here again, there is a partnership with the federal government and some of our foundations and a minority of dedicated citizens. But how much has been accomplished? The west side of Cleveland is today more segregated than Birmingham, Alabama. 5 years of fighting with the building trade unions has not noticeably increased the opportunity for Negroes to enter this field, and Cleveland still graduates from its high schools into apprenticeship programs the graduate of which cannot enter the occupation for which he is trained. Now, once upon a time, this city of ours was quite proud of its responsible and responsive government. 60 years ago, city government across the nation was pretty much of a scandal. It was notorious. These were the days when all manner of profiteers could put their hand into the city treasury. These were the days in which traction companies owned the city streets. These were the days in which contractors bribed openly city officials for lucrative jobs. These were the days in which councilmen could be bought, mayors could be bought, state houses could be bought, privileged legislation could be bought, and during those days, Cleveland held to its integrity. In 1904, the crusading editor Lincoln Steffens published a book which he entitled deliberately, The Shame of Our Cities. And he detailed all this crime and this greed and this collusion. Cleveland was the one shining exception. Cleveland, he said, was a well-governed city, perhaps the only well-governed community in the whole United States. We had then in the mayor's office a reformed robber baron by the name of Tom Johnson. Tom Johnson's philosophy was simplicity himself. I know, he used to say, I know that the utilities are a bunch of thieves and robbers. I was one of them once. And Tom Johnson saved, and his cabinet saved, our lakefront from the railroads. And he began the process which ultimately substituted the spoil system of patronage for civil service. And he rationalized the tax duplicate so that the rich could not escape paying their share of the cost of the city. Within 10 or 15 years, Cleveland had established a city manager form of government, which saw to it that the day-to-day routines of a community were exercised by men of competence who were trained specially in the techniques required for that task. I wonder what Mr. Steffens would say of Cleveland if he were to write a book about our cities in 1967. Surely he could not say that we are the best governed city in the United States, perhaps the only well-governed city. We lack even the office help to put together reports required of the central government through which we receive funds for our various projects. The standard of pay of the important offices in the city hall is so low that these men are constantly being lured away by industry and by other communities. After all, they have their own families and their own needs. This fall's series of reports by the little Hoover Commission has shown the impossibility of the tasks of city administration being carried out by abused and disenchanted men who are provided inadequate tools against an ever-mounting variety of urban managerial responsibilities. Now, it's tempting to blame the mayor for all of the administrative deficiencies of the city of Cleveland. Mr. Locher is anything but a good administrator, and he has not been forceful. But the fault is not his alone, nor his preeminently. The rust is old rust. Money is the oil of government. And this city has constantly been shortchanged by the state and by an electorate which is consistently penny-wise and pound-foolish. You cannot hire bright young administrators at less than subsistence wages, at meager wages, and not expect to have a brain drain, to have them drawn away from you by other communities and other projects and by industry itself. What are the policemen of the city of Cleveland picketing for today? They want a salary that's 85% of the average salary paid to trade unionists in this city. Is that really a great deal to expect? They have, of course, much less. Now, it's tempting to blame the mayor for the administrative failures of our city and all of those who are in one way or another guilty of having let our city down, have a scapegoat in the mayor. The mayor is not a man of great vision, but who has had vision in the city of Cleveland? The Union Club? The AFL-CIO? Our first families? Where shall we find the reservoir of vision? For a generation, the economically powerful have wanted representation without taxation. They've wanted to run the city, but not to be responsible to the polity, to the public. Cleveland has a long history of being run by newspaper editorials, by private telephone conversations, by discreet interviews between businessmen and public leaders, by a variety of interlocking committees and directorates. But a city cannot be run at long distance. You're either a citizen or you're not a citizen. And when City Hall or some of our very fine few civic leaders of vision have reminded their friends, reminded the business community, reminded the laboring community, reminded the city that we need all to share in all of the responsibilities of urban living, the response has been time and time again to defeat metropolitan government, to defeat every program of annexation, to raise higher and higher the enclosure walls which separate us out from the roiling violence of the city. When the mayor proposes that the legislators of this county join in Columbus for liberalization of the annexation laws, every single suburban mayor rises in righteous indignation. When the foundations spend $500,000 to rationalize and make reasonable projects for metropolitan government, is defeated by a vote of almost 5-1. A new governmental body has been brought into being in recent years by a federal decree, the 7-County Study Commission, a regional planning commission. I have seen not one bit of interest by the majority, the larger community, to explore what kind of larger structure, governmental structures could we create, improvise, reform, to satisfy the complicated needs of the mid-20th century. We hold on to our balkanized community, little enclaves of power, little groups of white people huddled against larger groups of black people, Little groups of wealthy people huddled against larger groups of not so wealthy people. Little groups who are proud of a school system huddled against school systems where there are larger numbers of children in the classrooms. We're a balkanized community, and the world has long passed us by. We're an age of federalization, a federation of regional planning. And unless Cleveland shows a willingness to experiment with the larger responsibilities and to share in the duties of citizenship, we will be a series of little enclaves at war with each other, unable to communicate, unable to plan jointly, unable to build any kind of decent future. We will be at the mercy of the experts, of the federal government, of violence, rioting. We will move into the future willy-nilly. The future, I'm afraid, will overwhelm us as it did the rats in their cage. Between shared responsibility and narrow self-interest, Cleveland has a long and sad history of worrying only about feathering its own nest. And yet it's obvious, isn't it? The present system is not only anachronistic and archaic, but self-defeating. Rot does not stop at the lines drawn on a city planner's map. The criminal uses the same streets as the businessman. There is no security for any of us until all are secure. And you will not vote your security by building high suburban walls against the fears with which you have invested the problems of the city. Cleveland, 1967. What can we say of it? Physically, is it attractive? Hardly. Politically, is it alive, vigorous? We have a horse and buggy government in the space age. In terms of the quality of its citizenship, well, we're going to blame the mayor, and we're going to blame the establishment, and we're going to blame the unions, and we're going to blame the newspapers, and we're going to blame everyone but ourselves. And yet the real problem of Cleveland is a personal problem, mine and yours, a problem that all 2 million of us share. We have feasted off the abundance and returned what? Indifference. A vote against taxes. Cant about free enterprise. There were riots in Huff last summer. There will be other riots. There were the shocking disclosures last spring of the United States Civil Rights Commission. There will be other shocking disclosures. There are the rats. And the rats have only spawned since we first heard about them. There's the overcrowding in the schools. And though we've worked on the school problem, it remains an aggravated one. There's a deterioration of our housing. There's a rapid rise in delinquency and in crime. This is Cleveland, 1967. A once proud city. Down in the dumps, we can fall further. There is no bottom. A city of nice, agreeable people who are simply too lethargic to be citizens. Some were disturbed last week when an honest mayor and an honest civic leader became angry with each other, and I was delighted. It's about time that we had legions of angry men. You can bury the city and say Kaddish over it, because of its sweet agreeableness. Oh, how we love each other. And we have a year-long brotherhood week in the city of Cleveland. And it leads to an action. We need angry men. Men of conviction. Men and women of daring. We don't need any more studies. This is the most studied and reported on city in the history of mankind. We don't need more experts to tell us now what is needed. What is needed is a change of heart. Your hearts. You and I and all of us have left our city down. We have turned away from it. We have busied ourselves with our backyards and our gardens, with our businesses and with our families, all quite legitimate enterprises. But we are buoyed up and encouraged and sustained and educated and made secure by the city. And unless we return to some measure of energy and skill and will, unless we become active citizens, we will watch as the rats watched, helpless in their cage. And some of us will become reckless, and some of us will become violent, and some of us will stand passively by when passers-by are attacked, and all of us will complain and wonder how, why Cleveland? We will know the answer, for we are the answer. Cleveland needs angry men who will burn out the evil that is within us, who will speak bluntly and act deliberately and do. Cleveland needs angry men of action who will see to it that these reforms are brought about, that the reports are taken out of their pigeonholes, that the dust is blown from them, that they are put to work. That instead of being a city which, in the name of urban renewal, tears down slums and leaves empty acreage as a garbage heap, we will be a city which will build schools and hospitals and parks, which will build the foundations of a decent life for all of us, for our children. The best location in the nation is an empty and hollow joke. The best location in the nation is an empty and hollow joke lived by all too many empty and hollow men. The time for action and anger is at hand. Amen.